So I'm here with Ambassador Alun Dombe Asamba, who was the Jamaican High Commissioner to the United Kingdom from 2012 until 2016. So first of all, Ambassador, thank you so much for agreeing to meet with me today.
And thank you. Thank you for inviting me to meet with you, and thank you for coming out here to meet me.
Yes, well, do you want to explain maybe where we are right now?
Okay, we are in St. Anne, which is on the north coast. A lot of people would know about Ocho Rios, which is in St. Anne. I'm actually in a little town outside of St. Anne, which is called Manig. That's the town. And I am in a village called Griafield. And my house is the Griafield Great House. And this is where I live. My son and my sister both live with me. My son has his own quarters, so to speak, and he farms. He's a non-chemical, what's that word?
Non-chemical farmer.
He's a non-chemical farmer, so we don't use any chemicals. And if you look around, you will see lots of wasp nests. My son says the wasps are the hardest working animals on the farm, so we don't kill them. The only thing they don't do for us is give us honey. But they do all the other things. They eat the pests, so we don't have to use pesticides. And they pollinate because they go from flower to flower. So we are very protective of our wasps. We know that if you get bitten, we know what to do. We just cut an onion and rub it on the bite, and no swelling, no pain, you're fine.
And I understand that a bit of history about this
area.
Beautiful house in the area, yes, that we're in at the moment. And this was a plantation, is that correct?
Yes, this was a plantation. They actually used to grow corn and cattle here. And in the back, you will see some barns where they would have the corn. They would store the corn. Also, we do not get public water. We harvest water from the rain, and we have huge tanks. I think we have a tank which holds over, don't quote me, huge tanks. And we manage the storage, and we also purify our own water. And we have two levels of purification. One level which we use for household and washing purposes and so on, and the other level which we use, the next level which we use for drinking and cooking and so on. So we're self-sufficient insofar as water is concerned, as long as we get rain, please God. Some of what we do here, we get energy from the sun, solar, but not everything, and we're moving towards that. So, you know, we're on a hill. If you notice, it's a Georgian house, and where we're sitting now is a Georgian porch of houses that were built in the 17th century. So this house goes back to the 17th century. All the stone that you can see there and all the wood that you see here came from this property.
And there were slaves at this property as well back in the day.
Back in the day.
A long time ago.
Yes.
Okay, so
we call them enslaved persons.
Enslaved persons, thank you. So you've had a really interesting career. You've been a lawyer, a politician, a diplomat, a high commissioner. Do you want to tell the people who will be listening to this interview a little bit about your career?
About myself? Well, let me say, I'm from a family, and I think my family epitomizes the Jamaican motto, which is out of many, one people, because on one side of my family I have enslaved persons and slave owners, and on the other side of my family I have persons who came to Jamaica as indentured workers. I grew up being taught that the people from India who came to Jamaica they volunteered to come to Jamaica. It is not true. They were kidnapped, just like the slaves from Africa. My great-grandmother was kidnapped when my grandmother was 6 weeks old and put on a ship out of Madras The ship was called the SS Peerless, and she landed in Old Harbor Bay and came off, knew no English, knew nobody, and had to make a life with her young child.
Mm.
A few years ago, when we commemorated the 150th anniversary of the Indian arriving in Jamaica, I had to take my grandmother and my grandma and my mom down to Old Harbor Bay, where they reenacted that particular thing. It was very emotional for us. On the other side of my family, my great-great-great-grandmother was born in a cave, because it was just before emancipation, and somehow the enslaved persons had heard that freedom was coming, and my great-great-great ancestor was pregnant and didn't want her child to be born a slave and ran away, and the baby was born in a cave. So most Jamaicans have this kind of memory of our past. Some of us don't want to think about it, and some of us have no choice but to think about it.
And we are here at a very historic time as well. We were recently talking about when I was on the Kingston, the London to Kingston flight, and mid-flight was when we heard that the
Queen had died.
The Queen had died, so it is a incredibly important moment, I think.
Because for us, we knew no other sovereign but the Queen for the last 70 years. So the majority of Jamaicans only know the Queen. Now we know a king. And the king has been to Jamaica several times. I actually met him in Jamaica for the first time, in the same way that I met the Queen in Jamaica for the first time before I went to the UK. And there's a picture of my meeting with the Queen. I was a senator at that time, and she and her husband, Prince Philip, as he was then, had visited Jamaica in 2002. I had met Prince Philip before in 1986 in Australia, when I participated in a program that he developed for future leaders of the Commonwealth, which was called the Duke of Edinburgh Study Conference. So Thursday morning when we woke up and heard what was happening, because of my experience of being a High Commissioner in the UK, I knew where we were going. You know, it was just a matter of time before the announcement would have been made. And I actually had said to a few people that I thought it was going to be made at 6 o'clock British time.
Mm.
And it was made shortly after, before 6:30 actually, which would have been like 12:30 our time. Yeah. So we're seeing history unfold here now.
We are, yes. Literally. So I also see that you were Jamaica's Minister of Tourism and Entertainment and Culture. Is that correct? What did that?
Yes. In terms of politics, I was a senator in the government of Jamaica, and in my final year as being a senator, I was appointed Minister of State in the Ministry of Industry, Science and Technology, Industry, Commerce, Science and Technology. And then I ran for elections as a member of parliament in this very same constituency where I live. And I won my seat. It was very strange because I had no job. Because when the elections was called, you had no job as the Minister of State or as a minister. Then I won the elections, and yes, I was going to be a member of parliament, but I said, I have no job other than being a member of parliament.
Mm.
Until I got the call from the prime minister to say that he was appointing me. At the time, my first appointment was Minister of Industry and Tourism. And then when Prime Minister P.J. Patterson retired and Prime Minister Portia Simpson Miller became the Prime Minister, she reappointed me to the Cabinet as Minister of Tourism, Entertainment and Culture.
Okay. So did that entail, for example, links with other countries, links overseas, or was it mainly focused on...
No. As Minister of as Minister of State, in the ministry responsible for technology, and we were doing a lot of work. Remember, this is what, 2001.
Mm.
We were doing a lot of work with improving our technology infrastructure, and we were involved in the Caribbean, and there's an organization called the Caribbean Institute of Technology. So I was involved in that, and I went to different conferences. I even at that time went to California and toured in Silicon Valley and toured the Apple setup.
That is really fascinating, because I know that there have been concerted efforts within Jamaica to improve, for example, to improve citizen registries and to improve the ways in which people's documentation...
You mean NIDS? National... NIDS, yes. That is another discussion altogether.
I just wondered if yes. In the early 2000s you were having conversations...
Not around that. In the early 2000s, we were having conversation about breaking up the monopoly for telephone, that we had a monopoly. At the time, the company was called... It was Cable and Wireless.
Okay.
Which later became Flo. And we broke up the monopoly that allowed for a company like Digicel to come in and get a license. We set up the OUR, the Office of Utilities Regulation. We set up the Fair Trading Commission, those kinds of regulatory agencies.
Mm-hmm.
To enable us to look at the issue of competition and how we were going to deal with competition.
And why was the issue of competition, why does it continue to be so important for Jamaica?
Because competition is something that matters. For example, you see something advertised in the press, or you hear it on TV or on the radio, and it says the cost is $100. And you go into the store or wherever to buy it. And when you go there, the cost is $150. Mm-hmm. That is called misleading advertisement. Or you go and you expect to get a particular item because it is advertised as being there and it is not there. But they sell you another item. And that is called bait and switch. And then, I've spoken about those two in particular, because those are the two that touch and concern the normal, ordinary Jamaican. And of course, the issue of keeping others out of the market so that you can maintain a pricing policy that is detrimental to the consumer. So those are issues. Our law does not say we can't have a monopoly, but it speaks to how you manage that monopoly. So you understand. So and then we were doing the work to enable us to break the monopoly that Cable and Wireless had at the time, to allow particularly other mobile telephone operators to come in.
Okay. So
And also as Minister of Tourism, I was involved in the Caribbean Tourism Organization and went to their meetings. I was, I would go with the Jamaica Tourist Board, who has responsibility for marketing Jamaica. I would go on trips with them all over the United States, Canada, and Europe, to sell Jamaica.
Yeah.
And during my time as Minister of Tourism, I established a fund, which is called the Tourism Enhancement Fund, which allows us to have funding for major tourism projects. Now, this is very important, because we knew that we could not get that kind of money out of the consolidated fund, out of the budget for the year. And also our private sector did not have that kind of funding. And I came up with the idea of having every ticket that was bought outside of Jamaica to charge $2 per day to a total of, at the time, $10. We worked it out that a visitor, a tourist, would spend probably 5 days in Jamaica.
Mm-hmm.
And so $10 and $2 for the cruise ship passenger would spend one day. And we started to develop this fund. Prime Minister Patterson, who was the Prime Minister at the time, when I went to him with the idea, thought this was great and said, go with it. And so I worked on that. And given my experience as a lawyer, I was able to assist in the drafting of the legislation, because the Chief Parliamentary Counsel told me, Minister, if we had to put it through our regular process here, we wouldn't get to it for a while. And I wanted it to be done within a year. And so I got somebody to assist me, and we drafted the law and got it passed.
Okay, so looking at your, how did you come to arrive in the UK, your post as High Commissioner? How did that transpire?
The party that I support, and which became the government in December 2011, they invited me, appointed me to be the representative of Jamaica in the UK. And what I need to say is that we have different kinds of high commissioners and diplomats representing Jamaica all over the world. But there are a couple of countries, and at different times, the government decides that they want either a career diplomat or a politically appointed diplomat. And so I was a politically appointed diplomat because I had no experience as a diplomat prior to that. But I had the experience of international exposure through my other experiences as minister.
And how was that experience for you?
In the UK?
Yeah.
Oh, it was a very good experience. I remember before I went to the UK, former Prime Minister Patterson met with me and told me that my experience as a member of parliament would serve me very well in the UK, because the Jamaicans living in the UK would consider me the equivalent of their member of parliament. So in
was that true?
Yes.
That was
definitely true, which is why I learned and had so much to do with the whole Windrush discussions and the activities and what was happening then. Because I now had to advise myself of what was happening. I had to know the history to be able to say to people, you have been here. You need to regularize your stay. And at first, when I started talking about it, because I had just recently gone to the UK, there were people who told me that I didn't know what I was talking about, because I had just come.
So let's break this down a little. Were these conversations that you were having with the Jamaican community in the UK, were they conversations you were having in a more formal setting with colleagues? Or
I had the conversation with everybody who speak to me about it.
So when did this start? Did you see it as a problem before you arrived in the UK?
No.
Or was it something that very quickly...
I didn't see it as a problem before I arrived
in the
UK.
So what happened then while you were in the UK?
Let me tell you. You have to know why there are Jamaicans in the UK, first of all. And I have a personal story about that, because in my family, my two of my uncles and one of my aunts went to the UK in the 1950s, because after the war, they invited Jamaicans and persons from all over the empire, as it was then, to come and help to build back Britain. And this is something that hit me. I knew about it as a child growing up, but I didn't understand it so much. And I had been going to the UK over the years before I was High Commissioner. But I realized that there were Jamaicans who worked in the transport sector, Jamaicans who worked as nurses, Jamaicans who worked as teachers, not so much then as now, but Jamaicans were involved in the telecommunications industry. Jamaicans who were involved in all different kinds of industry in the UK because they left Jamaica and they went there. And what happened is that somebody from a district would go and then would send back for people from that district. So that there are communities in the UK where you would find that most of the people have their roots in Clarendon or in St. Catherine or in St. Thomas and St. Catherine. You know,
that was very common, right? So you could go to certain areas. This interview is about you, but I'm from Birmingham. And there's certain, you know, you can go to certain areas and people have those close links to small towns and small cities in Jamaica directly because of that migration link, right?
Yes.
To say, come and we need
and come. Yes, so some people would go and say, hey, I'm sending back to my village for more people to come. I mean, this happened. So when I went to the UK, one of the things I did as High Commissioner was to develop, well, not to develop, because the links were there already, but for me, develop my personal relationship with the different Jamaican communities in Leeds, in Birmingham, in Manchester, in Bristol, in London, the various parts of London, in Edinburgh, in Glasgow, in different cities in Wales, and so on. So I developed these relationships, and they had very strong civic organizations in these areas, and they were focused on helping back home in Jamaica.
Can you remember the names of any of these organizations?
Oh boy. My brain. I could tell you another time, but there's so many that there's a Jamaican organization of Leeds. I mean, they have different names. They had names right now, I can't tell you, but we can find that out and you can know who they are. So I began to develop these relationships. I would be asked to speak at their functions and I would have to leave London, take the train, depending on where they were, overnight. And then I would also, not just overnight, but mix the visit to an area with meeting the civil leaders, the mayors and you know the chief of police,
of course,
those people. So yeah. I would mix a visit, especially my first visit, with the civil.
So essentially what you're saying, you had a lot of diasporic outreach, right?
A lot of it.
Is that typical for high commissioners, or was that more a personal choice?
No, I think it is part of what is. Remember, I told you that Mr. Patterson told me I was going to be considered the MP for the Jamaican community there, and they reached out. And
what were the kind of things they're reaching out to you about?
Just being there to tell them about what was happening in Jamaica, to come and find out what they were doing in their cities.
But did they have any specific concerns or any specific demands or things that they were asking you to help with?
Sometimes they would have. Sometimes they would have how long it took them to get their stay, you know, but I had to explain that this was not something that we had any control over. So what I learned very quickly, though, and I had in the back of my head an experience where my aunt in the 1980s, in fact, I can tell you it was 86, because I was on my way to Australia, and I stopped with my aunt, and knowing I was coming, she asked me to get a copy of her birth certificate because she wanted to apply for her citizenship. Now this was from Margaret Thatcher's time, yes, and at the time it was free. You could apply for your citizenship and it was free. This was in the 80s. And then after that, they charge £50.
I think it was £5 at one point.
Yes, so, you know, charge different cost over the years.
Yeah, they gradually started to introduce
Until by the time I got there, it was like £2,000.
Mm-hmm.
You understand?
And also depends if you've got dependents as well, that adds to it.
So I'm saying to you that I knew about this ability to become a British citizen from in the 80s.
Okay.
I knew about that because of my own personal experience of getting my aunt's birth certificate.
And were these people who had come with a British passport? These were people who...
The British, Jamaican, British passport.
Yeah, so they... So, but
remember, they were British.
Of course.
Yes.
Of course.
They were British.
The conversation then is around, that they had documents to say that they were British. B, they thought they were British.
Yes.
So the question there would be, why did people know to go through this process? Was it because of any campaign that they'd been aware
there
of?
Was,
or was
they,
it,
there,
were there warnings, basically?
There were warnings from then.
And what kind of warnings did people get?
I don't recall what it would have been in the 80s. But in my time, in the UK, I could see it coming because of because of what was being said and what I read in the news, and when I listened to people speak, I knew what the Home Office was saying. But more importantly, they had these vans with notices on the sides of the vans going around.
So you're talking about the hostile environment.
The
vans
hostile
that were introduced
environment
by Theresa May
that began to be introduced.
Yeah.
Yes, and so let me tell you, I spoke about it every opportunity that I had when I was speaking to the Jamaican community. And when I came home to Jamaica, I would be invited by different churches to speak, to say to Jamaicans who have family in the UK, you need to regularize your state.
So this is actually fascinating, because you were there in 2012.
I was there when things started changing.
Did you see those vans with your own
yes,
eyes?
Yes, I saw those vans with my own eyes.
Goodness me. And what, was that unexpected, or had
when
you
it,
heard about them
when
before?
I heard about it before
what
I actually saw it.
What were the reaction of people when they saw those vans?
You know, at the beginning, people kept saying, it doesn't relate to me.
Mm-hmm.
They're not talking about me because we are British. We came here on a British passport. Or our parents came here on a British passport. Or we were born here.
Mm-hmm.
But they never regularized their status in the UK.
And what mechanisms would have been in place for them to do that?
You'd have had to apply to the Home Office. Everything had to go through the Home Office. And the Home Office had different locations. People, I remember, let me give you an example of something that started to happen. I began to hear about people renouncing their citizenship.
Their Jamaican citizenship.
Jamaican citizenship. Believing that they could now, having renounced their citizenship, go to the Home Office and apply for UK citizenship.
So these were people of Jamaican descent,
or Jamaicans
who had travelled to the UK, who believed they were British to the extent that they denounced their Jamaican nationality, effectively leaving themselves stateless.
But it couldn't happen that way, you see.
Right.
There is a section in our constitution that speaks about renouncing your Jamaican citizen. And you have to apply to the government to renounce your citizenship. And there's a process. But somehow, and I'm going to say this, and it was really bad, but there were a group of notaries public, in particular, in Croydon, because I've seen those documents, that created a document which they called renunciation of citizenship. And they charged people like £500 to do it. And let me tell you, they used language, you know, like here and after and where before, and put on this red seal and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
It meant absolutely nothing. And people were duped into paying their money to produce that.
So why do you think people, I mean, that's desperately sad what you're just telling me, because mm-hmm. people were not only essentially being given documents that had no value.
Absolutely no value.
Renouncing a citizenship that actually they couldn't do,
not,
because they hadn't been through
formal process.
Procedures, but also thinking, I think the saddest thing in this is thinking that meant they would somehow then be British.
That somehow, having renounced the Jamaican citizenship, then the British would accept them as a citizen. So the tone of my, and the words that I started using in my speeches to the Jamaican communities is, this is not how it is done. You have to apply to the Home Office once you satisfy the requirements to become a citizen. You do not need to renounce your Jamaican citizen, because Jamaica allows dual citizenship. And Jamaica would never agree to a Jamaican renouncing their citizenship unless they had become the citizen of another country.
Yeah, of course.
Because then you become stateless.
Yeah, that creates a statelessness crisis,
yes.
Which is also a
whole
kind of
word. Part of the challenge that I faced was what I was saying to the Jamaicans in the UK is something that they had never heard before. It's something that they had never had to deal with before. Because everybody who went prior to our independence, which is 1962, went as a British citizen.
Mm.
Now, all of those people, if they were alive at that point, which was, 62, very few would have still been alive. But those, 62 was not that long ago. There would have been some people who had gone, and who, there were some that I met who had gone on their parents' passport, and they never ever got another passport in their own name.
Mm.
So there was a channel to become a citizen, and there was a channel to have, what is the word again, extended stay? Indefinite leave to remain, but it didn't make you a citizen.
Mm-hmm.
If you had indefinite leave to remain and you broke the law, for example, you could be
deported.
But people didn't understand that, and I tried. The High Commission, we tried.
People were getting indefinite leave to remain, thinking that meant that they had regularised their status.
Yes.
Without realising that,
it didn't recognise
them as a citizen.
No.
Yeah, and they would have to naturalise.
And they would have to do that, yes. So I spent a lot of time working on that. I must tell you, I spent a lot of time.
Well, who were the people that you spoke with at that time? Because part of this project is we're very much interested in understanding the, not sure this is the right term, but the diplomatic conversations that were happening at that time, so the influence basically of high commissioners and senior officials in actually saying, acknowledging that this was an issue and bringing it to those in power at Westminster, for example, or at the Home Office to say, there is a problem.
We did that. There is a caucus of Caribbean High Commissioners. And this is something that we worked on. And we had meetings with representatives from the Home Office, because it was something that was happening to all the Caribbean islands.
Mm-hmm.
Granted, Jamaica had the largest number of Jamaicans.
By far. Very high number. Yeah.
So we had a great interest in ensuring that that we spoke to the Home Office. But every time you had a meeting with somebody in the Home Office, they would tell you there's nothing they can do, because that is the policy.
Mm-hmm.
That is the policy.
And did you think it was helpful, the conversations then with your Caribbean colleagues?
It was helpful insofar that we all were on the same page, but we could not get
Were you aware of the extent of the scandal? I'm thinking back to
2012. No, at the time that didn't happen.
But whether, for example, so I've spoken to other high commissioners, and they can maybe remember an example of an individual case, maybe, But actually understanding or comprehending the extent of what was going on, that wasn't clear at that time.
Not at that time. Not up to 2016.
Right.
But I, you see, because of the experience that I've had otherwise and my legal experience and so on, I knew where this was going once I heard what the policy was. I knew that it was
going... You mean the hostile environment policy specifically?
Yes. Right. Once I knew that is where they were going with it, I knew that there was going to come a time that they were going to just deport people.
Yeah.
And which is why I had been preaching. Preaching is the word, yes. That people need to go and get their citizenship in order.
Why do you think people didn't do that?
Because they trusted the UK government not to do this. Honestly.
Do you think that was part of it? Do you not think perhaps people were also afraid of coming?
Some people were afraid of going forward because they thought if they went in to apply, then they would be nabbed and sent home. This is by the time the buses and with the signs started going around. That's when people began. I'll give you an example. Let me give you an example of the kind of things that I experienced. On weekends, I would go on the bus without my driver and go to places. I remember one weekend, a friend of mine took me down to what's that place there? There's a Peckham.
Peckham.
Yes, there's a TV show that speaks about Peckham. Yeah. That's what I was trying to remember.
Only Fools and Horses.
And I know not just that, there's another place at Peckham, Caribbean people.
Oh, yeah, Desmond.
Desmond.
Oh, yeah.
Right, and I used to watch Desmond Fantastic in Jamaica series. On a Sunday. So we take the bus to Peckham, and I'm walking along, and somebody comes out of a supermarket and bounces into me. You know that expression?
Mm-hmm.
Bounces into me. And she says, "Oh, excuse me, I'm so sorry." And I stop and I said to her, "You must be Jamaican. Now, you see what I look like. I could be anybody. I could be from anywhere," and so on. And she says, "Why do you ask?" And I said, "Because I'm Jamaican. And I get bounced by English people all the time. And they never ever apologize as you did. So I know you must be Jamaican." And she said, finally she said she was. So I then said to her, "Where in Jamaica are you from?" And she said, "Oh, I'm from St. Mary, I'm from Clarendon, I'm from St. Catherine, I'm from all over." And I said to her, "No, you can't be from all over. You must be from, there must be a place that you're from." And before she could answer, a young man came around the corner and saw me. And he said, he was so frightened to see me standing up on a sidewalk in Peckham. He said, "High Commissioner, what are you doing standing up out here on the sidewalk in Peckham?" Listen to me. You should see the change in the lady. When she realized who I was, and she says, "Oh my God, I didn't realize it was you, ma'am." And you know, when I tell this story, I talk about bow and scrape. Do you know the expression bow and scrape?
Yes.
It means you curtsy and scrape, you know, bow and scrape in Jamaica. And she started doing that. And I said, No. She says, "But I should have recognized you. My daughter loves you so dear. Can we take a picture?" And I stood there on the sidewalk and took a picture with anybody who came, because by then a crowd had gathered of Jamaicans who were around and said, "Oh, it's the High Commissioner. Imagine the High Commissioner walking about in Peckham." But the part of the story I want to tell you is that she would not say
where she was from
until she knew who I was. So the question you asked me about, was it fair? It was fair. By that time, it was fair. Because that would have been in either late 2015 or early 2015, actually, because I left the UK in May of of on the 1st of May, the end of April actually, 2016. So, yes, fear of saying, if I keep quiet and keep myself in my corner, they won't find me to send me home.
Yeah,
and you
so
are.
I think that's part of the picture of the voices that were silenced in all of this, right?
Yes.
The people that didn't come forward are the people that haven't. That aren't on any records.
Yes.
because of the fear.
Yeah,
which is a big thing. So did you have any individuals then that would come to the High Commission or maybe attend an event that you were speaking at to say they were having any problems or issues? Or
it's really very funny because there are times when I was speaking at these events and I would say, and for what I'm going to say now, I'm going to look up in the ceiling because I don't want to be looking at anybody who thinks that I'm speaking directly to you. And again, it is because of the fear. So there were people who wouldn't come forward because of this fear. And I kept having to say, if you're having a problem, come and talk to us. We will not report you. We will not report you to the Home Office. That's not what we do. We will give you advice as to how you may proceed. But we're not going to call the Home Office and say, oh, here is one person. No, we never did that.
I mean, did the High Commission give advice to people? For example, I did hear that some High Commissions were, for example, maybe putting a slip in people's passports just to say, make sure you have the correct paperwork or something.
We did that.
Because were you aware of Jamaicans being basically people coming to Jamaica and then being unable to leave?
Yes. And being unable to go back.
So can you give some examples of...
Well, not individuals, no. I discovered something about somebody who I had known for a long time. I knew him. He had come to Jamaica from the UK and lived here for a while. And when he was ready to go back to the UK, he couldn't go back because his passport had expired while he was in Jamaica.
His British passport.
And they would not... In fact, there's a story in the newspaper about it. If you probably do some research, you will see some stories of people who that happened to.
And yeah, I believe you have your own story as well at the moment that when I spoke to you.
My story now? I have had a British passport for a long time. And then British visa.
Visa.
For a long time. And then when I became the High Commissioner, I got a diplomatic visa. And then I was no longer the High Commissioner, but my visa still was in place. But I couldn't use it because I was no longer a diplomat. I had a plan to go to the UK before COVID hit. And I had to apply for a visa and go through all the process, notwithstanding the fact that I was a Jamaican High Commissioner to the UK. And then COVID came, and I didn't get to travel, and my visa expired. I'm planning to go to the UK in October, and I have had to go through the entire process of applying for a visa, and it has become, it's like 13 pages that you have to fill out. And you now have to, I don't recall having done this even when I had my private visa before 2020. I don't recall having to produce, I might have done a job letter, but I didn't recall having to produce the title for my house, the title for my car, bank statements, all of those things, which I had to do 2 weeks ago. To get this visa, I haven't got the visa yet. I hope I'm getting it. They have my passport. I hope I get it before the week is out.
And what reaction did that provoke in you then? How do you see that process, which sounds overly bureaucratic?
I must admit that I had to pay my travel agent to fill out the forms with me, because I don't do forms very well, and she would know what to do, because you can't move on to another page until you complete one page and sign off on that page. And
we and it's all electronic, right?
And it's all electronic. Yeah. And then you have to download all these documents to send. You have to download your passport. You have to download all these kinds of things. And then I got a very early date. So I went on a Saturday morning to fill out the forms and to send them in. And I got a date for the following week, Tuesday, which was good. And
where were these papers being processed, sorry? Where in Kingston?
Well, I had to go to Kingston to do the interview and the biometrics. So I went into Kingston to do my application with my travel agent. And then I went back into Kingston to do my biometrics. And a funny thing happened. I left all my papers here at home in St. Anne. Thank God I had put my passport in my handbag. And my son was ready to jump in the car, his car, and to drive in to give it to me. But I had this light bulb moment when I said, but my travel agent has the papers. Let me call her and have her print them again for me. And we got them printed and I got back, because thank God I had got there early. So I had an hour in which I could do that. And I went and I got them. And I went for the interview. And I must admit that that went smoothly.
So what kind of questions did they ask you at the interview?
Well, everything was there already. So they didn't really need to ask many questions. They need to know that I was the person in front of them. So they asked me what was my full name and my date of birth. I don't recall anything else. I spoke to three different people. And they all asked me the same question. And then I did the fingerprints. And the picture they took, must be my eye scan, I don't know, whatever. And in half an hour I was out. And they kept my passport. So hopefully I will get it. And I will get my visa, because I paid quite a bit of money.
And was there any opportunity on the form to say that you were the former British High Commissioner to the Jamaican High Commissioner?
So I think there was. Yeah. I think there was, because they ask you for a list of all of your employment. So I think there was a place there that says that.
Okay, so going back to the time that you were in the UK from 2012 to 2016, more or less, which really was an important moment in terms of...
That was when the changes...
The Windrush scandal kind of erupted in 2018, but
right.
Really,
you could see it.
But it came out of the time that you were in the UK, yes. Right?
And as I said, I could see where it was going.
And you said you could see that, you linked that to the fact that you, for example, you're a lawyer, you understood kind of, you could see the kind of bigger picture and understand the intentions as well of the Home Office and what they were
I could understand the speeches that were made.
Right, so can you give an example of a speech?
Oh,
there?
Lord. I'm sorry. I.
But do you think maybe the language?
The language.
There's been a notable shift then in terms of the British government and how it was talking about and how it was addressing.
You know, I could see, let me tell you, I must say this, Brexit. Yeah. The Brexit, the whole period of Brexit, and my listening to it and my seeing what is happening, I linked the two things together.
In what way?
In the way that I heard people speaking. The funniest thing, I would talk to people who were in business in the UK. And I remember one particular person whose name I won't call, but he is a peer. Non-English, but he is in the House of Lords. And he has a business. And I remember being at an event and we sat together. And he talked about coming to the UK with £50 in his pocket and developed his business and da-da-da-da-da and so on. And he said to me, you know, if I employ 1,100 people, only 200 are British. All the others have come to the UK. And I found... that was the case for a lot of people who were employed in in business, in who had businesses at a certain level in the UK. I would also, when I'm driving around, there were certain places that you pass and you see all these men hanging around, and I would ask my driver, what is this? And he'd say they're here for work, to try and get day's work. Construction site and so on. So people who were doing work like that on construction sites or just building works or whatever knew where to go to get those people. And then I heard the rhetoric around Brexit. And I said to myself, if they are saying those things about people with the same color as them, what are they going to say about our people? And I started to join the dots together. And I saw it coming. But really, when it hit me that this is where we were going, was those vans with the signs on the side of the vans. That confirmed in my mind that this is where we were going.
That is a hostile environment.
Yes.
For sure.
Very, very much so. And that started from, I was there.
That's 2012.
Not so much 2012, 13, but 14, but you could see it really, building up to that.
It built into this Brexit discourse and the campaign and everything. And how did that make you feel, basically, as a woman of colour and Jamaican?
I was pained because... It's a news bug. I was pained because I kept saying to the Jamaican community, we were invited here. Do not let them forget that. We were invited here to help Britain to rebuild after the war. Do not let them forget that. There are people who drove the buses. There are people who worked on telecommunications, who worked in the power company, who worked in the hospitals. I had reason to go to the hospital in the UK because I hurt my meniscus. I tore my meniscus and I had to have surgery. And most of the people who were working in the hospital were not British. They were not. They came from somebody else. And then they started to come to Jamaica to recruit our nurses and our teachers. And I would go and speak to people in schools. I would go and speak to students and I would see the teachers and now it's happening even more now. We're losing teachers and nurses.
So I'm interested.
So
we have a very crazy bee in the background that you can hear, if you can hear the buzzing. Quite an angry bee, which is adding some flavour to our conversation.
But you're on a farm.
Well, it's fine. We're in a beautiful place. I'm interested about what was happening then with the High Commissioners who were in London. In terms of, you said you could see it coming, you saw the hostile environment vans, or the go-home vans. You were very sensitive and conscious of the rhetoric that was happening in and around Brexit. What was happening? Was there any strategic organisation or beyond the caucus of the Caribbean?
We started to identify lawyers who would assist persons to make their applications. But part of the challenge is by then it had become so expensive. It had become so expensive.
To apply. Which again is part of the hostile environment,
It's to price people out of it. But remember, this was 2016, up to 2016, and they hadn't started with the flights and all of that yet. But I think since then other things have happened. I'm not up to date on what has happened since then.
And have you met anyone in Jamaica who was deported, or anybody that's that maybe got caught up in the scandal and have been vocal about it or on the media
I've heard, but not personally. I haven't met anybody personally. But I know people who are Jamaicans who came home and who are not interested in going back to the UK. I know communities of people. because usually they go back to where their community is, or they buy into a community where there are other persons like them who are there. So I know people who don't go back, or people who only go back because they might have need for health issues or so on, but they're not going back there.
To the UK?
To the UK.
They want to stay here, they're choosing to stay here because of the...
They choose to stay
because
here.
Of the situation.
Because of the environment, yeah. But many of them are citizens, but even with that, it's a different place for them.
Right. And so how do you see... It's a big question, but how do you see the future? I mean, what do you think... do you think we're heading in terms of Jamaican British...
When Britain realised... that they don't have the workers that they need to do the things that they need to do.
Well, also, as we said at the beginning of this interview, it's a very historic moment. The Queen died last week. And obviously there's the issue of reparations.
And there's a new king.
There's a new
and
king.
And there's a new prime minister. And I don't know that those of us outside of the UK, and I'm being very careful here now, have taken the measure of the new prime minister. No, that's not going to bite you. That's a very
angry bee we have.
It's not a bee, you know.
So I'm very sorry. You were talking about the measure of the new prime minister.
Yes, we haven't seen the measure of the new prime minister yet. Although I have persons who have said things that. You know, I don't know. We'll see. I can't tell you what's going to happen. It's not a me, so it's not going to bite you.
And just finally, then, to wrap up the interview. So, what are the what kind of discussions have you had with your colleagues, with your political colleagues, about what has happened in the UK and your impressions?
You mean now or
well, everything really about the impact of the hostile environment, about the reach of the Windrush scandal. Is it something that resonates really here with people on a day-to-day basis, or is it
probably not on a day-to-day basis? It resonates with the people who have family that is affected, you know, and when the matter is brought to the government. However, my political arena is out of government at this time. We're in opposition.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are not being called on to do something, except to say that in the first week of October, the leader of the opposition is going to the UK to talk with the Jamaicans there. And I will be, if I get back my passport in time,
you will be in the UK, surely.
I will be in the UK. So I will be with him in my capacity as being a former High Commissioner. And I will get a better chance to see what is happening now on the ground than when I left it in 2016.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for your time today.
You're welcome.
And for welcoming me to your beautiful home as well.
Thank you. And we need to get you something to eat.
We will do that now. Thank you so much.
Who's calling me? Lordy. I'm going to... Give me 1 second.